and take it back. And the flags will fly at half staff during the inauguration, something President Trump has decried, saying it's the first time, because Biden has called for flags to fly at half staff for the 30 days after Carter's death.
Yes, the return of Panama was a huge symbolic and material correction of an injustice. Panama was a province of Colombia. The United States, Teddy Roosevelt, teamed up with J.P. Morgan to basically, coax a revolution there, an insurgency, and declared, recognized the independence of Panama, and then built a canal and that the United States controlled, the Panama Canal Zone, and Carter's return of it. It was very symbolic.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor of history at Yale University, Greg Grandin. And finally today, our deepest condolences to Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez on the passing of his mother, Florinda Guillen. She was 97 years old. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Tina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Anjali Kamat, Sharina Nadurasa, and Malkoff Tamari, Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during our year-end campaign, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give and join the team.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon finalizes its wildfire hazard map of the state. Markham Elementary in southwest Portland reopens after a year of ice storm repairs. And in national news, President Biden establishes two national monuments in California. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 7th, 2025. I'm Josh Salem. Oregon released the final version of the state's wildfire risk map. This latest version addresses prior critiques and tries to clear up where there is the most risk for residents and property owners. It categorizes every property tax lot into a different hazard zone, low, medium, or high. It also shows which properties are at the wildland-urban interface. Those are areas where structures like buildings and roads intermingle with forests, rangelands, and other wild areas. Properties that are in high hazard zones and at the wildland-urban interface will be the top priority for mitigating the risk of wildfire. In the future, there may be extra requirements for those properties, and owners would be notified through the mail. That could include things like increasing defensible space around a home or adding fire-hardening improvements. The maps first came out in 2022, and they got a lot of criticism from Oregon property owners. They said many properties were miscategorized as high risk and worried the maps could be used by insurance companies to jack up their rates. The Oregon Department of Forestry says they've made those and other changes to improve the map. Senate Bill 82 bans any insurance company from using the Wildfire Hazard Map or any other statewide map to make decisions about whether to offer coverage or increase rates. Residents can find the wildfire map and explore it for themselves online at oregon-explorer.info. Where do people go who are ready to leave the hospital but still need care? Oregon has a backlog of patients that hurts hospitals financially and means fewer beds are available for people who need them. A task force has released its recommendations for this year's legislative session, including more funding for long-term care facilities, among other things. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Oregonians who are ready to leave the hospital but still require care do not have enough places to go, impacting providers and patients at all levels. The average hospital stay has increased to nearly 5 days, according to the Hospital Association of Oregon. With nowhere to send discharged patients, hospitals can end up boarding them, which hurts hospitals financially and means fewer beds are available for people who need them. Senator Deb Patterson was part of a task force that has released 10 recommendations to address the problem. The Salem Democrat says a top priority is presumptive eligibility for Medicaid, so people who likely qualify don't have to wait for their applications to be processed in order to receive care, which would also benefit providers.
Long-term care facilities need to be assured that the patients they're accepting, they already have their insurance in place.
Increased reimbursement rates for adult foster homes are high on the list for the task force, as well as continued funding for guardians. Guardians are court-appointed positions that make decisions for adults found incapable of caring for themselves because of dementia or other health problems. The task force, which included representatives from hospitals, nursing homes, and union leaders, says expanding medical respite is also critical. These programs provide short-term residential care for people experiencing homelessness who don't need a hospital to recover from an illness or injury. Patterson says not having access to places to heal can be deadly.
I would really advocate for funding for medical respite, because we do not want to see people dying on the streets.
Another issue contributing to the backlog of patients is staffing shortages in Oregon's skilled nursing and long-term care facilities. Patterson says the state is collaborating with Future Ready Oregon to grow the healthcare workforce, including CNAs. She adds that another bill is in the works for spring, focusing on entry-level positions in long-term care. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Markham Elementary School in Southwest Portland will reopen after a year's closure because of repairs. Both Markham and Gray Middle School were severely damaged in the January 2024 ice storm. Gray reopened in August, but Markham was on a longer timeline. The ice storm broke pipes, leading to water damage on the ceilings and walls. The repairs were slowed down by crews finding asbestos, which they had to be careful to dispose of properly. Students and teachers were parsed out to four other local schools in the meantime. Today was the first day students were back in the building, and for some kids, it was their first time at Markham at all. The building didn't get a full overhaul, like the repairs the school district has been doing at area high schools, but there were some accessibility improvements made. Markham is the most racially diverse elementary school on the west side of Portland. 15% of students are Black, 11% are Latino, and another 11% are multiracial. Parents say the closure was tough, but that the teachers and administration pulled through to continue to support the students. The Washington State legislative session begins next Monday. The most pressing topic will be the state's budget shortfall. Legislation on rent stabilization and gun control could also surface. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The next legislative session is approaching in Olympia, and Washington State's budget shortfall will be one of the biggest topics. A gap of $10 to $12 billion is expected over the next 4 years. Jerry Kornfield, a reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Washington State Standard, says a number of ideas have been thrown out. He says Democrats are considering increasing taxes on businesses and wealth or excise taxes.
They've also talked about a higher tax on the sales of super expensive properties. So they're really targeting wealthy individuals and large businesses in many of their proposals.
Kornfield says the budget deficit could make it difficult to fund other priorities, such as in education. Because of the gap, he doesn't foresee major changes in education funding this session. Republicans say reducing spending is the better option for shrinking the deficit. The session starts Monday. On the housing front, Kornfield says rent stabilization went far in previous sessions and could be on deck this session.
Democrats are going to try to push it across the finish line into the governor's desk this session. They have more members in each House and the Senate. They seem poised to really impose a statewide limit on rent increases, monthly rent increases or annual rent increases of some percentage.
Kornfield says the priorities of newly elected Governor Bob Ferguson will likely determine the direction of the session. He notes there are some non-budget related topics that could surface, such as reducing the blood alcohol level for drunk driving. He says gun-related legislation usually bubbles up, too.
There are bills, again, been introduced that would further narrow where people can openly carry weapons. There's also going to be probably a good fight on this bill requiring individuals to have a permit before they purchase a weapon.
Kornfield says the legislation could involve a gun safety class for people to get a permit. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Electric vehicles are still trying to win over customers in states with colder climates, amid concerns that freezing temperatures will limit how long the battery will last for each trip. But industry voices say features such as heat pumps, which prevent significant drops in range, are now standard on newer models. Mike Mullen tells us more from Minnesota.
Despite recent gains in sales, electric vehicles still face skepticism over concerns like the battery not holding up in cold weather. But industry groups have a message for drivers in Minnesota. You can still drive your EV when it's freezing outside. Research has found that bitterly cold temperatures can reduce the average driving range of an electric vehicle from anywhere from 25% to 41%, depending on the circumstances. Ingrid Malmgren with the group Plug-in America says while some of these effects are real, they can be overstated. She also points out that emerging technology is reducing the impact frigid temperatures sometimes have on the performance of an EV.
A lot of EVs now include heat pumps to help the batteries be more efficient and to work better in cold weather.
And experts say drivers can take certain steps to ensure their commute goes smoothly. That includes using a setting on most newer EV models that warms the battery to an optimal temperature, allowing for faster charging. Federal data show EVs aren't the only ones affected by extreme weather. Gas-powered cars lose between 10 and 20% of their driving range when the temperature drops significantly. A recent Plug-in America survey of more than 3,000 EV owners found that 70% of them worried about battery range before buying an electric car. But Malgren says the outlook improved after the purchase was made.
Once they are familiar with EVs and driving them, these concerns largely go away.
The concern level dropped to 35% in the ownership phase. The vast majority of those who remain concerned about range own EVs built before 2020 and live in rural areas where charging infrastructure is scarcer. Drivers typically travel longer distances. However, federal grants are helping states add more charging stations along interstates. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
Groups that fight for a healthy environment are calling on government at all levels to restrict the production of plastic, saying the focus on recycling programs has been a failure. They say it's more than just a waste issue. Suzanne Potter reports.
Environmental advocates are calling for a paradigm shift to combat plastic pollution, to reduce the amount of plastic we produce rather than solely focusing on recycling. Only 9% of the world's plastic is recycled to date, and even less in the United States. Melissa Valiant with the nonprofit Beyond Plastics says she's disappointed that a United Nations conference in December failed to produce an international plastics treaty.
Real change would have required a set reduction of the amount of plastic being produced, and that failed to happen. This is why local and state policy and even federal policy is going to be so important moving forward.
The UN will meet again later this year to try to hammer out an agreement. California will ban all plastic shopping bags starting next year, and the state will require single-use plastics for packaging and foodware to be 100% recyclable or compostable by 2032. Valiant says the federal government has not done enough so far to curb the production of new plastic.
We're definitely going to need policies to require companies to reduce the amount of plastic they're producing because they are not doing that on their own. In fact, they're ramping up production.
UC Santa Barbara Professor Roland Geyer says we need to address the problem at its source by reducing production and consumption of virgin plastic material.
Every ton of material we produce will become solid waste eventually. We might get a few cycles out of it. We might keep it in the economy for a longer period than we currently are, but it will all become waste.
A report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development found that without setting caps, banning some plastic products, and reducing pollution, plastic traffic is set to balloon by 70% in 2040 compared with 2020 levels. This story was produced with original reporting by Sheehan Kim for Sierra Magazine. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with an overnight low of 39. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny, with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1999, the U.S. Senate begins its impeachment trial of President Bill Clinton. The quote of the day is from American Harlem Renaissance author Zora Hurston, born this day in 1891. She said, "Love, I find, is like singing. Everybody can do enough to satisfy themselves, though it may not impress the neighbors as being very much." Vice President Harris emphasizes the fragility of democracy. Public health advocates debate RFK Jr.'s cabinet nomination. And Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau announces his resignation. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I do believe very strongly that America's democracy is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. Otherwise, it is very fragile, and it will not be able to withstand moments of crisis.
Kamala Harris stressing the importance of a peaceful transfer of power. The vice president presided over the Senate as it certified the election of President-elect Donald Trump 4 years after the January 6 attack on the Capitol. She underscored her constitutional responsibility to ensure that every American vote counts, even during moments of division. In spite of the smooth process so far, David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research warns that election denialism could resurface depending on the outcomes.
If in 2026, Democrats do well in the midterms, I think we could see many Republicans who embraced election denialism in 2020 embrace it again in 2026 and similarly in 2028.
Becker also notes that while denialism has primarily been a Republican issue, there are signs it could grow on the left as political tensions remain high. The president-elect still faces legal hurdles. New York Judge Juan Merchan has denied Trump's request to delay Friday's sentencing in his hush money case. Trump's lawyers say they will appeal, and his supporters argue the case never would have been brought if he wasn't running for president. The president-elect has repeatedly said the case is just a political attack.
Mother Teresa could not beat these charges. These charges are rigged. The whole country's a mess between the borders and fake elections, and you have a trial like this where the judge is so conflicted he can't breathe.
Merchan says he will probably not jail Trump or put him on probation. Advocates are voicing concerns over Trump's nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Amy Adams with Progress Iowa says many in rural health care are uneasy about his controversial vaccine positions and his promotion of baseless health claims.
They didn't want to see vaccines discontinued. The individuals who had seen polio and the impacts of it, and just the concerns with Kennedy and his ties to misinformation, vaccine conspiracy theories.
Kennedy's supporters, including some Democrats, praise his push to reduce corporate influence on the U.S. food supply and to eliminate harmful chemicals from everyday products. Finally, across the border, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is stepping down after nearly a decade in power.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
Trudeau's Liberal Party has declined disastrously in the polls, and Trudeau himself has faced sharp criticism from close allies. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
President Biden established two national monuments in California, helping to restrict these lands from resource exploitation. Tribes are celebrating the decision in the last 2 weeks of Biden's presidency. Telling us more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders and elected officials are celebrating the establishment of two national monuments in California by President Joe Biden, the Chuckwalla National Monument and the Satitla Highlands National Monument. Together, they will protect 848,000 acres of lands, which include tribal cultural and sacred sites. The Tribal Council of the Fort Yuma Quetzalan Indian Tribe in a statement said, the protection of the Chuckwalla National Monument brings their people an overwhelming sense of peace and joy. U.S. Senator Alex Padilla in a statement said, it's another victory for safeguarding California's public lands for generations to come. Tribal leaders are also calling on President Biden to designate one more national monument in California before the end of his term, the proposed Quetzalan National Monument. Tribal leaders and California state lawmakers held a press conference in Sacramento last fall, urging President Biden to designate all three national monuments in the state. Native American California Assembly member James Ramos, during the press conference, talked about the significance of the areas to tribes.
By designating these areas, it's not just designating a monument. To us as Indian people, it's a way of life and protecting our lives of our ancestors and who we are and for future generations to move forward.
Alterina Santiana, secretary of the Torres Martinez Desert Quia Indians, was among tribal leaders to speak at the press conference.
We want it to be where our ancestors, they were able to enjoy it and live in it. And we also want that for the present and for the future generations, where we can also share this with our communities that are in our surrounding areas. We can educate and we can teach about our culture.
President Biden is expected to sign proclamations Tuesday creating the Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. In South Dakota, the push to secure justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women remains a priority, but some advocates are seeking more resources. The issue has garnered more attention at the national level in recent years, including the 2023 launch of an outreach program led by federal authorities. South Dakota is a host district for one of the handful of U.S. attorneys assigned to the effort. While the extra leadership might be helpful, Tanya Grassel-Critlow with the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault says there is still not enough funding to accelerate meaningful progress.
We are desperate for funding. And then without funding, we are not able to provide advocacy to work with the families of the missing and to work with the potential victims who we've identified through a lot of factors who have the potential to become missing.
She spoke during a recent forum hosted by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Panel members also said agencies still do not share enough intelligence to prevent crimes. Funding came up during a congressional hearing last fall, and a key lawmaker pledged a bigger level of support moving forward. But it's unclear what that will look like when budget negotiations resume in the spring. Lily Mendoza leads the Red Ribbon Skirt Society based in Rapid City. She says federal officials have improved their listening efforts when grassroots groups speak out on the issue. And she says they see good relationships with local law enforcement, but her team still has to fill in gaps to ensure accountability.
You know, I got a call from a parent. They're concerned about their child. Can you check into this? So those systems that the Not Invisible Act is supposed to be putting in place, the grassroots organizations are taking that on.
Mendoza Plaza specialized federal unit that launched in 2021 that can more freely navigate the country to look into these cases. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Iran has sustained setbacks in its economy and its Middle East policy. As one observer notes, the incoming Trump administration is likely to take advantage of Iran's weakness. But, he says, the opportunity exists to strike a deal that would enhance security for all sides, including Israel. Now we go to global citizen commentary on that issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Taking advantage of another's troubles, that's the danger Iran faces from the next U.S. administration. Iran's domestic and international positions have seriously weakened, inviting Donald Trump to pounce. For Iran, weakness invites either of two international directions. One is pursuit of negotiations with a stronger adversary so as to buy time and save resources to devote to domestic problems. The other is to seek a winning weapon that will deter the adversary and unite the citizenry. Iran is at a decision point where it must make a critical decision on which direction to take. The Trump administration waits in the wings. It is populated with hawkish advisors who, like those in Trump's first term, are inclined to use coercive means against Iran, at a minimum to get it to stop enriching uranium to bomb level, and at a maximum to seek regime change. Iran's policy choices must take into account the sources of its sudden weaknesses. One is its economy. Iran's government has had to take power plants offline in the midst of an unprecedented energy emergency. Industries throughout the country have had to shut down for the year, causing losses estimated in the tens of billions of dollars. Schools, government offices, banks, and other structures are getting electricity only sporadically. Internet service is unpredictable, and Iran's currency, the rial, is in free fall, and the country is in darkness. For Iran, this crisis comes atop others. Its ally in Syria is gone, leaving in its place an Islamist regime likely to be unfriendly toward Iran. Syria's collapse means a weakened Hezbollah, which until now had relied on a friendly Syria to allow weapons shipments to Hezbollah's forces. Then there's Israel, where right-wing politicians close to Netanyahu are publicly calling for direct attacks on Iran to eliminate its nuclear program before it advances further, and before Iran repairs its air defenses, which were badly battered by Israel's attack on October 26th. Making matters worse, the Israeli right has an incoming president in the United States who is likely to support Israeli military operations beyond its borders, even including a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Iran's leaders have to consider that they won't get much, if any, help from Russia or China should Iran be attacked. The incoming Trump administration ought to consider ways short of military options to deal with Iran. Trump has the leverage with both Iran and Israel to make a deal that keeps Iran from going nuclear and avoids another Middle East war. The leverage with Iran is sanctions, which have added to Tehran's economic woes. Iran can put on the table the drones and missiles it has been sending to Russia for use in its war against Ukraine. A reduction of both the sanctions and Iran's military aid to Russia could constitute the basis for a U.S.-Iran agreement that would lead to Iran's halt of uranium enrichment and Israel's backing off on attack plans. Trump, however, may find that a negotiated solution to the current situation is not as attractive as a win, meaning support for an Israeli strike that sets back Iran's nuclear program for years. But he should recall that his previous tough policy toward Iran failed. After Trump pulled the United States out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran and imposed heavy sanctions, Iran did not fold. To the contrary, it accelerated its nuclear bomb-making program, though stopping short of 90% enrichment that is necessary to produce a weapon. Iran has also relocated its nuclear weapons program to deep inside a mountain. Attacking that site would be unlikely to destroy it completely. Will Trump nevertheless conclude that Iran this time around is too weak and too vulnerable to worry about its response? Will he decide that a negotiated agreement looks too much like the deal Obama concluded, and which Trump strenuously criticized? Odds are that Trump will opt for increasing military and economic pressure on Iran as a first step. If that pressure doesn't lead to a clear concession from Iran on its nuclear activities, the chances are slim that Trump will engage in prolonged negotiations with Iran. If he pursues further coercive measures, Iran's grievances against the U.S. and Israel will last another generation. Iran's people will suffer, and Iran will be more likely to build a nuclear weapon arsenal once it recovers. Reflecting on those long-term consequences should lead to a U.S. policy based on win-win diplomacy rather than one based on zero-sum confrontation. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 7th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Grutov, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegetoff, and Mike Moen. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.